The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic yet realistic mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
Hello, this is the Culturico podcast. My name is Gerfried Ambersch, and I'm Culturico's poetry and literature editor. Today, I will be speaking with the poet and writer Zilka Joseph. Zilka, welcome to the show.
Hello, Gerfried. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm honored.
My pleasure. Our pleasure, for sure. The reason we invited you, of course, is your latest book, which is called In Our Beautiful Bones, which is a collection of original poetry. And I hear it's been nominated for some awards. Is that correct?
Yes. That's correct.
That's fantastic. Which ones are they?
They're the Pen America, the Pushcart, and more recently, I think, for the Griffin Book Prize from Canada and a Hoffer Award. So there are a couple more that they have nominated me for.
So it's an honor to speak with you, of course.
Thank you.
But before we really delve into, you know, your poetry and the book, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey, you know, sort of like your background, things like that?
Sure. I was actually born in Mumbai. My father was a sailor. He was a marine engineer for the Scindia Steam Navigation. And we lived there till at least I was quite little when we moved to Kolkata. Calcutta, as it was called before, now it's back to its original name, Kolkata. And so I personally say I'm a Kolkatan because I feel very connected to that city and to Bengal and to Bengalis. And as we do in India, we absorb a lot from all the cultures around us. So we speak in different languages from the states we've lived in. We absorb information and knowledge of the religions of the people around us. So you will see in my writing, there are references not just to biblical characters or events, but I'll talk about the Upanishads and I'll talk about nationalist songs and poetry. And of course, my influence of Western cultures also comes from the fact that we were colonized. We were a British colony for so many years. So much of our education and cultural references and the books we read all were very much a part of that. And a lot of my journey has not just been sort of being immersed in all these different cultures, as well as my being a Ben Israel, from the Ben Israel community of the West Coast, the Konkan coast of Mumbai. We were not religious, but I think in many ways, my father was quite a free spirit as I am. And so though I'm influenced by a lot of that, I am extremely open and free-spirited as a person. But that helps me to absorb and embrace and understand and also bring to my work a very wide range of subjects and song and food and culture and everything that makes me who I am. I came to the U.S. In 1997 with my husband. And for many years, I couldn't work or be employed for a while till I got my green card. And then I went back to teaching in different capacities. But it was only in 2007 that I gained admission into the Zell writing program at with University of Michigan. It was a scholarship for 2 years and a very prestigious one. So it was very, you know, an emotional moment for me when I got accepted into that program. And I had already written a chapbook before I got into the program, but I was really serious about getting into writing and the literary scene in a much more serious way. So, and that has brought me to Ann Arbor, where I've established my own work ethic and business and teach private writing workshops. And I work with clients and students to coach them and help them get published. So that in a very nutshell really is my
many lives. It is. It would fill many lives in other people's lives for sure.
In fact, I feel overwhelmed when I have to talk about it sometimes.
Well, of course,
I don't know what to talk about and what to leave out.
Yeah, I think it shows in your writing, which is just very eclectic in the same way, culturally and you know, literary references that you have in there. And of course, it's quite a clash of cultures that you seem to, you know, experience, like at least that's the sense you get from reading your poetry in particular. And I find because this is a little detail I find utterly fascinating, and I did not know anything about you mentioned the Ben Israel background that you have. I was not aware of that. I think that would be interesting for listeners to hear a little bit more about, because it seems, you know, because obviously the name geographically, it seems a bit misleading, but it refers to, can you call it a tribe of Indian Jews, or like, tell us something about it.
Sure. Even in the West, in America here, though, there is, you know, in general, American Jews and the culture here is very large. But I am kind of at this little tip of this iceberg that is part of a different world. Right. And I think even here, only more recently, I think, and forgive me if I may be a little ignorant about this, people are becoming more open to inquiring about other Jewish populations, mm-hmm. and are beginning to write or beginning to invite people like myself into the fold to come and talk about the Ben Israels. So I really, I feel great talking about this, because I myself for many years didn't speak about it very much, because I would just feel very overwhelmed and people would say, mm-hmm. what, who are you, you know, and or they would have strange comments like, really, or, you know, they're not too sure they believed me that I was really Jewish, you know, and that's something that happens when people don't have that knowledge.
No, of course.
But it takes a while to sort of sink in. And in fact, the other day I sent somebody an article on Chinese Jews, and they were so shocked. And I said,
of course, yeah.
We
it's
have,
not what you expect.
but that's what, you know, I hope to, with my poetry and when you give me opportunities to speak like this, I hope I can bring more people to read more about our culture and Indian cultures. And in fact, in India, there were three different communities of Indian Jews, all with different origins. And more recently, two more have been added to that group. So there's a lot of research still going on about these communities. But the Ben Israel are perhaps the most ancient in their origin, because it was so long ago that people still don't have the exact evidence of when they arrived in India. But the story is quite fascinating, because apparently two ships were shipwrecked in a storm on the west coast of India. And that itself is quite a romantic idea. It's quite fascinating.
Right, yeah.
And so these people, apparently there are various theories about that. And some of them are that there were seven males who survived. And then there is another theory that said, no, there were seven couples that survived. And so they integrated into the life of the Konkan coast. And there was never any hostility. They were accepted. They learned the language of the land. They learned the customs of the land. They dressed as Indians did because they had, I mean, that was their new life. So even though right. they knew the Shema, they knew they, some of the prayers.
But they retained their religious, you know, affiliations to some extent,
Gershwit, because what they remembered was their Shabbat, Sabbath.
Right.
So they would observe the Sabbath. They would light the lamps or the candles or the oil lamps to observe the Friday prayers. And so they got their name Shanwar Telis, or the Saturday oil pressers, because they never worked on a Saturday. So they were called Saturday oil pressers.
That is so interesting. That is so interesting. I had no idea. Definitely going to read up on it.
Yes, and there are a lot of theories of when they arrived, but perhaps one of the most popular ones is that they were fleeing from Galilee and the rule of the Greek overlord Antiochus Epiphanes in 175 BC. And that's really, really a long time ago.
That is a long time ago. And it's such a fascinating, it just goes to show how complex, you know, like human history is, and how interesting, you know, those different journeys can be.
Absolutely.
And fascinating. And there's, I understand there's a connection between that culture and the artwork for your book.
Absolutely. Yes, I would love to talk about the artwork. This beautiful, beautiful painting is by Siona Benjamin. Mm-hmm. And I had stumbled on her work. She is also a Ben Israel artist, and her work is just beautiful. I encourage people to check her work out. And I had stumbled on her work some years ago. I had never contacted her, being kind of reclusive and a little shy. And finally, when this book came out, I was so keen on having something done by her, because so much of her work related to my experience, that I did write to her, and I got this section of this one. This is part of two panels, but this is one of the panels. And somehow that whole image of that woman rising and the wings sprouting, and that whole sense of struggle as well as transcendence was so appealing to me. And I felt that it fit the book beautifully. So I did write to her, and I did work out something with her, so I could have her artwork on my book. So do check her work out as well. And so it's quite interesting. I'm Ben Israeli as a writer, and she is this absolutely stunning artist who has her, quite a big following in the US.
That's fantastic. Listeners, of course, can look up your book on your website, which is zilkajoseph.com. That's Zilka with a Z and Joseph with a PH.com. And just to very briefly describe, because I have the book in front of me, I'm, you know, one of the lucky owners of the book.
I was delighted to send it to you.
Yes, Gurfrey. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Because you can't enjoy a book in a PDF, you know.
You have to hold
it in your hands and feel it and smell it.
I'm very much old school in that regard, for sure. Right. But just to describe the cover in a few words, there's a woman in a sort of a nightgown, like suspended in the air. And what I first thought were sort of like rays coming out of her. You just described as wings. So I see that.
And they are rays as well. So I do agree with that interpretation.
And there's some, you know, ornamental flowers and plants. And I see it at the head of a tiger, I believe.
Right, at the bottom there. Absolutely. You know,
it's a lot to take in. It's a good visual. It really captures your poetry visually. And
I just add one more note to this, Guthrie?
Yes, please.
What Siona does is she is inspired by what we call miniature paintings of the Mughal mm-hmm. period. And India has a very long tradition of different kinds of miniature painting, different schools of miniature painting. So a lot of these will have a framework within which the stories are told. So we have this kind of background of flowers and that tiger head peeping in at the bottom. And then we have the main subject in the center.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
When I ask you to, you know, introduce yourself, I used the word journey. And, mm-hmm. You know, that is no coincidence because you've had, you know, quite a journey throughout your life. And mm-hmm. one of the first poems, I believe it's the opening poem in your book, is called mm-hmm. Voyage, which of course right. means journey. And if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you to read it to us because it's you know, such a privilege to hear a poem in the poet's own voice. And this poem, I think, really sets the tone for the rest of the book, and sort of like gives a little overview of, you know, sort of like the cultural influences that you've had. So please, Zilka, take it away.
All right. Thank you, Gottfried. So yes, this poem, Voyage, as you will see when I read it, has a lot of references to different kinds of journeys. It mm-hmm. has an epigraph that I've used is, the Upanishads explain how wisdom can be absorbed through sound, how the ear is a vessel, the receiver of divine messages. And so the theme of travel, the theme of voyage, the theme of even the ear being a vessel, and vessel mm-hmm. is also a ship. So we have this sense of journeying in the more literal sense, journeying in the sense of my own story, my own life, and then the episode that I'm describing in the book. And then I refer back to the journey of my ancestors, those ships that were perhaps shipwrecked on the coast. The Konkan coast is the west coast of India. And there are two areas in which these communities grew. One was around Mumbai in Maharashtra, and one a little further north, Ahmedabad in Gujarat. And both these places have some traces of history. They have cemeteries which still hold the graves of some of my relatives and ancestors, great-grandfathers, etc.
Okay.
So there is a lot of history there. But what I try and do in this is I'm actually talking about a storm that I encountered when I first moved to Michigan near Pontiac. And this storm came through, and then I'm in the car, but then I have these flashes, these visions of my father and his sailors in a storm. And then it sort of reaches out into much more mythical structures.
Right. So it captures the whole journey, so to speak, like even
right.
sort of like back to your ancestry and you know, all the way to your new home, which is Michigan. So
exactly. So okay. I'll read it now for you.
Yes, let's hear it.
Yes. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Of course, yeah.
And
thank
the Upanishads are from our Hindu scriptures. So
okay,
that's a way that I sort of quite easily move back and forth between all these registers and these references. So the poem is Voyage. The Upanishads explain how wisdom can be absorbed through sound, how the ear is a vessel, the receiver of divine messages. The lightning fell, and I only knew that it entered my eyes, and thunder repeated words in my ears I could not understand in the gray blue light of evening. A sheet of silver drew itself like a shroud over my car, its engine an animal thrashing in the hold. My heartbeat like oars, slamming hard against every climbing wave. My hands on the steering wheel, clawing at it as if it were a raft. At 16, my father sailed the Bombay steamships, nearly deafened by their sound. Gales, ice, sent Elmo's fire striking on the high seas, then sailed diesel vessels through squalls when the sky was black and the water black, and the sailors' hearts shrunk from fear, all listening on deck and on the bridge and in the bowels of the engine room to what the thunder said. And turning into a vacant lot on Opdyke near Pontiac, the storm washed me clean off the road. Wipers swept leaves and yellow-black sky into sea foam. I watched the windshield bulge like a goatskin. It strained but held. Then a dam of white light broke, the wall of water shattering its cargo, and me inside it, like a seed giving itself up to water and to wind. In the west, the sunlight crashing in the broken branches of oaks burned a tunnel of sienna through which the bow of my ship rose to meet the horizon. And my father, the chief, roared to his engineers, their faces streaked with oil and boiler suits sweat-drenched, men whose torn lips bled as another peal shook the flailing vessel. And we turned our faces to the upper deck, like our Jewish ancestors wrecked on the Konkan coast thousands of years ago. We waited, but no calm came until the wind suddenly fell. My car almost shoved onto its side, now only swayed. A metal cradle spat from the mouth of thunder. I smelled its breath. Its teeth left bloodless marks on my skin. My bones shook. And though it was gone, I felt its pull, a lift, a nameless terror, and my deafened ears received every word it said, what it had said to my ancestors, what it had said to my father and to his men, as it had let the sailors go, as it had let my father go, and let us all go home.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
That was very beautiful. Great to just hear it, you know, come out of your mouth. And because as I said earlier, and I think that's also captured in that opening citation that you included, the power of sounds. And I think in poetry especially, sounds, okay. You say poetry is sort of like this interplay of sound and sense.
Absolutely.
And I think that really captures it. If you have a couple of nice, you know, let's call them sound effects in there, you know,
right.
Get your alliteration and so forth. But it's mainly because I also teach poetry. I'm not a poet myself, but I teach the theory, say. And so mm-hmm. of course you always the first thing is always, you know, you sort of try to detect whether or not what the structure is, you know, sort of like go see what it, how it's structured. And I think all of this piece, but I think all of your poetry in this book, at least, you're using free verse, right? So you're not following a strict meter, and there's, it's also
right. verse. So but a lot of it is still very crafted in that there is a deliberate reason why something is like maybe in tercets and then a single line, or whether it's a prose poem or it's a poem that has indentations. So there is a lot of thought given to each poem, even if it's not, you know, a particular form. The only one that is in form is A to Z of Foreign Anguish, mm-hmm. which is an abecedarian or abecedarian, which is quite popular in the US. And I've tried to challenge myself by making it what's called a double epicedarian. So okay. I run, if you take a look at the poem, it runs down from A to Z as the first letter of every word on the left.
Right. See, that's...
And that's what's normally done. But I tried a trick by putting it in the last letter of every...
Oh, okay. Well,
so
you see,
people play with these various combinations. So
yeah,
it's quite
interesting how you like. I think poetry very much benefits from sort of like this almost a lack of space. You're sort of like limited. There are limitations, you know, sometimes self-imposed, like the ones you just mentioned,
where you
try to force yourself to stay within those parameters, you know.
Correct.
and then that's kind of I find, and I think that's well understood, that really brings out the eloquence and sort of like the poet within, you know, sort of, because you have to work with these limitations. You have to sort of really make every word count, you know what I mean.
Correct. Every word count, and it's challenging but also very gratifying, because it's sort of flexing these different kinds of muscle. And then there's also an element of play.
Yes.
So in my previous books, in my earlier book called Sharp Blue Search of Flame, I have many other forms like the sonnet and the pantoum and a villanelle. But in this book, because there was so much, you know, so much of it was storytelling, I allowed a much more looser form for many of the poems and allowed also a lot of spoken word effects. Spoken word poetry in America is a very, very well-known form and very well-used form. So some of that, the effects you'll find in poems like God of the Great Blue Window, which has a lot of sound effects and is very, very, very akin to spoken word. And also to some extent, A to Z of Foreign Anguish, which is the abecedarian. Actually, the abecedarian is traced back to Chaucer in his Canterbury Tales. So it's this idea of
playing with language and using language not just to convey information, but to actually foreground the language itself. And that's just a way of doing it. I mean, rhyme would be another, right? I mean, it's also
absolutely limitations.
Absolutely. You're creating a kind of artificial scarcity, you know, around the language you're allowing yourself to use. Mm-hmm. And that then opens up different avenues, you know, of
possibilities.
Poetic expression.
Absolutely. And there's another poem called 10 Takes on Snow, which is a poem, is a sort of a take on 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. And, you know, so these things come automatically. Sometimes you sort of sit down with something, but sometimes when you're looking at something and you're writing it and you realize, hey, I can try this form even with the raw material. So it comes both ways. You can sit down with a form and try and do it. And then sometimes I have raw material that I am I'm working with, and I say, what if I try this? Or what if I put it in a form of villanelle? You know, so I do have other villanelles and things, but they're not in this book. I'm hoping it will be published in my next one. But it's just wonderful to try even the forms like the ghazal, which is a form that the poet Agha Shahid Ali devised and brought, literally taught America, which I play with sometimes. But again, this book does not have a ghazal. But I would be very excited if your listeners and readers would look up these forms and enjoy them.
No, it's very enjoyable to, you know, see you know, wordsmiths at work and to kind of, you know, get that there, because it's I mean, of course it's an art form, but there's also a lot of skill involved, right? A lot of verbal
it's
skill.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
That's
because it takes a lot of time.
Exactly. And sometimes if you think about the shorter the text, you know, the more, if you take a sonnet, for instance, right? And you have these very strict limitations. And I imagine, you know, it would have been very difficult for for poets to
Yes, you have to say a lot more when a poem is short. You know, it's not a narrative.
You say more
it's
in
not...
fewer words,
right? That's, and more lyrical. Sort of like it becomes much more lyrical when
musical.
You sort of
see that's
absolutely.
Sort of like a connection I always draw because obviously, right. Like one of my field of expertise, if you want to call that, is song lyrics. And
yes,
and so
I would love you to talk some more about that actually, because that's why I was excited to send you this book, since I have
so
many song lyrics
in
it. Yes, I was hoping that you would talk about
maybe,
that.
Maybe yes, and maybe later we can hear some of that.
Sure.
No, I mean the basics about it are just that as soon as you're working with sounds and poetry does that and music does that as well, and you combine the two, you can, you know, if you do it if you do it right, you can really get the best of both worlds there, and musical sounds can enhance poetry within and vice versa, and so on.
Right. So lyrics are poetry, you know, they just become part of you.
Yes, I mean, there's people disagree. There's, you know, I mean, of course, first off, you have to, I would say, to call something poetry doesn't necessarily mean it's good poetry, right? So it can be like, so because some song lyrics, I would consider them poetry, but, you know, sometimes they're lousy poetry. And by that, I mean, they're made up of cliches, right? They're not, they're not original.
Yes.
They don't have that. Right.
Yeah. But it's the popular song lyric, right? The popular song lyric is appealing to an audience that can relate, and you know, those cliches appeal to them. So that becomes a whole other
exactly
form.
Because it's and it's a fine line between a cliche and you know this what you would call like a topos, right? Sort of like from Greek, like sort of like something that's understood without, you don't have to explain it, right? It's like a commonplace,
exactly.
Topos means place,
right.
Is a kind of commonplace expression, something like that. And those are very, very important, especially when, you know, time or space are scarce. And another way to transcend sort of the limited space and time you have in poetry and music, of course, is through intertextuality. And I was very pleased to read the phrase "What the Thunder Said" in The Voyage, which of course, I mean, it makes sense in the poem, but of course you would be reminded immediately of T.S. Eliot.
Exactly, right?
Or like "What the Thunder
That's
Said."
That's the subversive part of that poem.
Exactly, because what happens there is you read that line and you suddenly, you know, maybe
what
the thunder said many years ago, you know, and it's part of
but it was deliberate. That's a subversive aspect
right.
of this
it's part
this
of
poem.
The wasteland and of course the wasteland has been described as the most important poem of the 20th century by critics and So, of course, you're drawing this, you know, you're sort of like transcending your own book.
Right.
You're drawing this connection and you pull all that meaning that's, you know, like intertextually, you draw on that all that meaning that's contained in that highly influential poem. So, you know, it's things like that. But and this brings me to my next question, which is as a writer and a poet, what would you count as your main influences? In terms of other writers.
Yeah, right. I think, I don't necessarily think of any specific writers. Of course, because my education was in English literature, British literature, a little bit of American literature. I'm deeply influenced by the Romantic poets and the Victorian poets and some of the modern poets, you know, T.S. Eliot for sure, Dylan Thomas and all of those, Shakespeare. But I think growing up, we are so influenced by our beautiful folk tales and nursery rhymes. And I'm talking not just of folk tales and nursery rhymes and epic literature from the West, you know. I mean, we're reading these storybooks of epic heroes from mythology across the world. So it's what was read to me by my parents and my grandparents, and the books that I picked up, and the stories of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and the stories of the Bible, the stories of my Muslim, you know, friends and my Hindu friends. So there was so much I was absorbing as a child that it became one to me, you know. And it's only when I'm writing and all these different things are showing up in my writing, much of it is so organic to me that I sometimes I'm surprised when somebody asks me a question about, you know, a particular reference. And then I realize, okay, I need to explain, you know, how it's gotten here.
It's really where it opens, comes in. You know, Pandora's box in a way. Because,
exactly.
You know,
especially the last poem.
Influences and so on.
Exactly. So I might have a Sanskrit song. I might have an Urdu lyric. I might have, a word in Hebrew. And so much of it sort of flows through me. And of course, when I'm actually doing the editing and the crafting of it, I want to make sure that it's having the effect that I want it to have. And if it doesn't, of course, I take it out or I change it or I think about something else. But it is quite organic to me in my thinking and the way these allusions and references flow through me. And that's why it's very interesting that you did mention D.S. Eliot.
Yeah,
hidden.
hidden,
you know, under there, the ghost of D.S. Eliot.
Exactly, it's still very much alive in among other places. Your poetry, which brings me to probably the most difficult question: Do you have a definition of poetry?
I don't. Per se, but I think poetry is different things to different people. Mm-hmm. And I think for people who enjoy it at a more popular level, it's something that they can relate to, they can enjoy, they can sort of become one with, or be told stories. I see the storytelling aspect to me in poetry is very important. And I think sometimes in academia, that aspect seems to be forgotten sometimes, or even looked down upon sometimes. And mm-hmm. I think for readers who are more literary or are more interested in literary writing, they can sort of access all these different forms and varieties. For me, I want my readers to think a little bit and delve a little bit into things that they may not know about. I hope they learn something new from my writing. But I think poetry should be whatever moves you.
So
for somebody who reads something simply written and it appeals to them at one level, but there may be another reader somewhere else who is reading much more sophisticated and technical poetry. And for them, poetry is something else. But I do believe that in the writing of poetry, you have to consider craft. Anything you write is not a poem, is what I tell a lot of my students.
Okay, yeah.
You have to make a poem.
Right.
You have to know what from your first creation, you have to lead it up to that polished gem. So
right.
Everything you write is not poetry. Mm-hmm. Yes.
No, it's not necessarily. I mean, there are certain parameters that, you know, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with this very, very basic definition of poetry by Terry Eagleton, who said that it's the type of writing where it is the author and not the word processor who decides where the lines should end.
Absolutely. That's definitely one definition. And if you look at this book, there are long lines, short lines, tiny lines,
you make that decision,
one word lines.
Right.
I want to create a particular effect. I want the eye of the reader to make those leaps mm-hmm. or to go along the story with that long line. So I have a poem, which is her story, which actually was sort of inspired by jujitsu, which is a kind of nature writing in Japanese and Chinese poetry. But it sort of began there, and you deliberately break up the order.
Okay, yeah.
So there's an element of
surprise almost.
Correct. Uh-huh. And so with each poem that I may be trying to achieve a particular kind of effect. All right. So a lot of thought goes behind, even if it just feels like a very simple narrative, I have made that choice to make it so. Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, no, of course you've made that. Yeah, exactly. You've made that choice. You've expressed yourself in a very sometimes concise, sometimes a little more elaborate kind of like way. But mm-hmm, you made that decision. You made something right. with words, right? Rather than correct. Just use them to convey right. information. I'm sure you're familiar with this. I mean, I'm only paraphrasing, but this quote by Wordsworth, where he said that sort of like writing poetry is an overflow, or you know, being overflowed by powerful feelings and then recollecting them in tranquility. Does that correct. Describe your approach also?
I'm very familiar with that expression, and I think it describes some of my work. Mm-hmm. And I some of it is just a thought that is bothering me a great deal, or a particular line that bothers me. So I would say, yes, that would be one of my approaches. But again, it's not an approach. It's something that comes very organically, as Wordsworth himself says, right? It's recollecting something. Right. So when I am recollecting and those emotions are being poured out on the page, then I already have like this nugget of a poem or the core of a poem that's forming. But in another instance, it might not be a recollection. It may be something I've overheard or something mm-hmm. I'm reading. Very often it's what I'm reading that my brain just leaps and goes off at a tangent.
Kind of like a trigger, and, you know, some
exactly. Like a word and triggering, I think, is very, very much part of what us poets work with. And sometimes it's conscious and sometimes it's very sort of organic or subconscious. But I would say I don't have any one particular way of writing or a process of writing. It is a lot of, and sometimes it's forced, but I'm sitting down with something and saying, okay try this. But
right.
most of the time, it is whatever is happening in my mind at that time and things that I'm processing. And sometimes it could be just grief, something that I, you know, mm-hmm. January and February are months where I've lost my the birthdays for my parents. There are dates where I've lost my parents. And I'm putting together a new chapbook of poems about my father, which has a lot of sailor and sea and voyage images. So somehow I feel as if that's speaking to me more in these 2 months. So I'm honoring that, and I'm trying to put together this chapbook of poems that have the larger metaphor of the sea and being a sailor and, you know, all the mm-hmm. the good things about being a sailor and the harsh things about being a sailor on the sea and, you know, having your family not there. And it's very intuitive.
Right.
And very organic.
That kind of brings me to the issue of themes mm-hmm. and motives in your poetry. And we already kind of covered or addressed the traveling aspect, which of course in mm-hmm. your case mm-hmm. is very much linked to this aspect of immigration, which mm-hmm. then in the next step seems to me very much involved with, you know, sort of a sense of, let's call it like maybe maybe non-belonging is too strong a word, but culturally, yeah, I get the sense that's there, and right. Kind of a sense of in-betweenness, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, absolutely, Gurfried. It's so much part of being the wanderer, being the traveler, and sometimes you're at home somewhere, but at the same time, you're the outsider. You're the, you know, the stranger in right. some ways or the
and
other.
I really like how you sometimes bring it down to very mundane, almost observations, you know, so things about, you know, like food or language itself, you know, there's a couple of texts in there that, you know, where you address these issues. Do you feel that is just a very vivid or relatable way of expressing this sense of in-betweenness by, you know, really breaking it down to these like everyday occurrences almost?
I think it's important to within the world of poetry, where we're kind of reaching out for, you know, mythic proportions and ideas, that the daily, the quotidian becomes also very important, especially where things are unspoken or as voices of outsiders, we're afraid to tell our stories. So some of these little incidents, you know, where the smell of your clothing, just because you cook Indian food, can be expressed in a way where a lot of Indians would relate to that, or people from Eastern cultures or cultures with different foods. How are they perceived when we work in a Western country, you know, which is our home too?
Exactly.
So I think some of these things, I hope, will start more conversations, you know, and of course, in one poem, I very, you know, deliberately say turmeric is a buzzword, garam masala is a buzzword, you know, people are talking about these spices all the time.
Okay.
But I'm sort of subverting that again, because, you know, Indians are not just Indian cooking and spices, but I'm deliberately putting that in to sort of stir things up a little bit.
Right. Almost playing with the cliches, right? I mean, that's
correct.
Exactly. I mean, there's an element of, you know, not necessarily in your poetry, but sometimes quite useful, like an element of kitsch,
where
you can just, you know, just pushing cliches.
Right.
To
right.
you know, the verge of you know, ridicule almost, or whatever
correct.
You want to call it. It's quite a
correct.
You know, it's a very fine line that you have to sort of like walk there.
Right. So there's a deliberate sort of cheekiness or playfulness when some of that happens, and then some of it is also defiance against, you know, a larger system that all of us have been subjected to as well as a part of, you know. So, you know, there is a lot of playing with that fire in this book.
Right. Yeah. I mean, playfulness is, that's a good description. I think that's really what it comes down to, because you're playing with words, you're playing with sounds, you're playing, as I said, and you just explained, with cliches, with, you know, all these little
right.
cultural details.
Right.
It's a right. very rich, eclectic mix of things. But as we're nearing the 1 hour mark, and I don't want to go too long, I want to thank you for coming on the show. And I was hoping that you, as a strong finish of this podcast, give us another poem.
Right. Thank you so much, Gurfried. I'm just delighted to be here. And I'm so delighted that a very different audience audience of listeners will have an opportunity to meet me, and I will have an opportunity to meet with them. So I hope people will contact me via my website or through you. I would love to hear from them. And thank
before
you again, Gurfried.
Start-
and I will end. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you. As I said, my pleasure, our pleasure. For folks at home, maybe repeat your website address once more, and how
sure.
people can get in touch with you or
absolutely.
You know, find your work.
Right. My website is www.zilkajoseph.com, ZILKAJOSEPH, .com. I'm also available on Facebook. So if you'd like to send me a comment or a message, that would be great. And on my website, under the workshops section, there's a contact email. But so just check me out and see if you have any questions or thoughts. I'd love to hear from you. And my final poem.
Which one is it going to be?
I'm going to read "O Say Can You See," because it reflects my thoughts on America. It's a thought on the national anthem, as well as how immigrants across the world bear the weight of a lot of different kinds of burdens. And there's hope as well. And at the same time, it allows me to do a little bit of sort of spoken word kind of poetry as well. So thank you. And this is my
thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Oh, say can you see? Look into my eyes, America, how easy it is to dream in technicolor. Oh, say white, say red, say blue, and every color. We who made and make you still. We have built your towers, your tracks, your bridges with our bones. From sea to shining sea, this is our home. Home is where the heart is. Yes, all the broken ones, we pick your fruit, sing Hosanna. We build our hearts here. We bake bread that we break together. We give thanks for each grain. We feed the hungry, for we have known hunger. See this mouth, it sings peace in every language. Watch my face shine. It will light up your pavements, your alleys, your castles, your shacks, your thirsty fields, like a harvest moon after blight and famine. And give back to us the dollars like shekels you have stolen forever. Study then the maps inside my eyes. See the world. Yes, feel my heartbeat, touch my human skin. It is real. And see our scars. They are the same. Our scars, we carry them thick and ugly. We are no stranger to dust and ashes. Here is my war-torn hand. Here are my lips. Let me kiss your cheek. Where do we end? Where do we begin? When I say love, I mean you. When I say home, I mean you. When I say to you, we are so beautiful, do not turn away. Do not shatter America, America. For richer, for poorer, we are your beautiful bones. Your heart, your veins are made of us. Why are you afraid our blood is the same color? Our skin so easy to dissolve. Frail border between this world and the next. Oh, sing with me, sing with me. What is made one should not be pulled asunder. We who are embraced by sweet Lady Liberty, we who are made so beautiful, so varied, so new, so whole again inside the harbor of your arms, O America. We are you, do you not see? Do not lead us into darkness. Do not hate our gods, our children. Throw us not into camps, prisons, ghettos. Smash your jackboots into us, but deliver yourself from that dagger, the dagger you can become. Thank you so much.